Well, here we go. We're going to take your phone calls next with our guest, Robert Bavall, the Egypt Code. A couple more things I want to talk with him about, and then we'll go straight to your calls. Robert, the Hall of Records, and I want to talk about the Egypt Code, then we'll take our calls. Fast show. It's going quickly, my friend.
Yeah, it does, huh?
What do you, if the Hall of Records exists, I happen to be a very staunch believer in some of the predictions of Edgar Cayce, so in the fact that he believes they were put there 10,500 years ago, which echoes your thoughts on the age of the Giza pyramids. But if the Hall of Records was put at the base of the Sphinx, what might be in there?
Yep. Well, let me say something else to what you just said. It isn't just the date that comes up in my research. And the interesting thing is that we arrive at this date through pure mathematical and astronomical logic. I mean, there is no hocus-pocus here. So that's the fascinating thing, is that through a scientific investigation, we arrive at the same conclusion as the intuitive investigation that Edgar Cayce did. I mean, that's amazing. It kind of proves that you can arrive at the same conclusion from an intuitive side. The other thing that we came up with is that there seems to be a message. When you read the language that is used at Giza, this kind of strange, geometrical, mathematical, astronomical language, it ends up by saying, look under the Sphinx, and you will find our origins in 10,500 BC. That's what the message says.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, whether we like it or not, that's what it says. If I am correct, if Graham and I were correct, and everything points to it being correct. So it's so strange. I mean, suddenly we enter this world of Cayce, because I was very much a non-believer. And I have to say that I'm very reticent at looking at things in this way. But it forced me to consider this. You know,
yes.
You arrive sometimes in your life when something happens, and you've got to take that plunge. You've got to take the leap of faith.
And it doesn't mean, Robert, that you've been wrong. It means that you've just changed. You've grown into some other belief system. And, you know, that's just the way it is.
Well, you know, we live in an ethos of processed culture. You know, we're told what to believe and what not to believe and what's good to believe. But at the end, there are certain things that happen in your life where you cannot simply ignore them because they don't fit the system. And this is one of them. You know, there is a man who said there's a chamber under the Sphinx, and it was put there in 10,500 BC. And there is Graham and I coming up with the same conclusion through a scientific approach. So what do we do with it? You're forced to consider it. And that's what we did. And what's in there, if the conclusions are correct, must be something to do with the origins of civilization.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe also the plans, the schematics for the pyramids. Somebody had to construct it. Somebody had to write it out, didn't they? And
well,
they put it on what?
You know, the funny
papyrus?
Sorry to interrupt, George. I'm a bit rude that way. But anyway, well, the funny thing about this is, you just mentioned the word plan, is that we actually have a document that is known as the Westcar Papyrus. It dates from the Old Kingdom. It tells the story of a magician who goes to the court of King Cheops, the builder of the Great Pyramid, before the pyramid was built. And King Cheops asks him, give me the plans of the pyramids. Tell me where they are so I can build one similar one. I can build the chambers. He calls it the chambers. He wants to build these chambers that are supposedly in a plan that was brought down by the gods. He says that. So there you are. I mean, the Egyptians themselves actually say they had a plan, and this plan came from the gods, whoever they were. And that's what Cheops wanted to do in his pyramid. So, you know, we can be cool and pragmatic and pretend that we are sort of kosher Egyptologists and say this is a load of rubbish. But, you know, there they are, these monuments. I mean, one of the things that my brother says always is, you know, no matter how you want to look at them, they're there, and they're baffling. And we want to brush them away because they don't fit the ethos. Well, maybe one day we'll all be baffled. Maybe one day we will find something there that is going to completely baffle us. And that's the feeling I get, you know, no matter how many times I look at them. You know, I wake up in the morning. I used to wake up in the morning for the last 3 years and go on the balcony. And it's as if they're screaming out loud, you know, we are going to surprise you, you know. You know, you can be as cool as you want, but there's something in there that's going to come out one of these days.
And maybe, dramatic. Mitch, shock civilization.
Yes. They're themselves shocking as they are. But there is something there, a message, an artifact, something that one, I feel it. You know, it's one of those feelings that is going to shock us. It's going to wake us up to something that many refuse to consider, that perhaps we are far older than we think. Perhaps we come from a higher pedigree, that we are not at all what we think we are.
Oh, would that be an incredible find? Let's take a few calls, and we'll get into the Egypt code here. Let's go to you, Chuck, in Illinois, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Chuck.
Hi, George.
Hey, you're with Robert Bavall. Good to have you with us.
Hey, George and Robert. I have a question for you, Robert. I'm reading in Exodus 5 right now, just something I fell onto, where the Pharaoh had told Moses that his people could not get, or he would not gather any straw for them to build bricks. Why? What buildings did they use the bricks on? And I had also heard that probably 4 or 5 years ago on Coast to Coast, where somebody else who had an idea that the upper blocks on the pyramids were actually bricks. I just wanted your thought on that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, we have two types of construction throughout the pharaonic civilization. What they built to use practically, in other words, houses, palaces, warehouses, these were built of bricks. It's as if they didn't really care much for their survival. Indeed, that's the reason why we found absolutely nothing of these kind of structures. We find tombs, we find pyramids, we find temples. And the reason is that to them, the temples, the pyramids, the tombs were meant for eternity, and they used blocks, they used stone, and large stone, as we were saying before. Now, there has been a theory presented quite a few years ago that they may have cast those stones. They may have actually made concrete.
A poured theory, right?
Yes, a poured theory. There is two schools of thought. One that says, yes, we support this theory. There is a certain amount of evidence that seems to support it. I'm not a supporter of it because there are various factors that I don't want to go into in detail here because they're very scientific, but indicates that it's unlikely that they poured those blocks. But, you know, I'm open to the idea. But that's the answer that I have for you. They did, in fact, cast bricks. I mean, they used straw and mud and clay, and we have some example of this. They did build early tombs, which we call mastabas, out of these kind of bricks. And when you look at them now, they're kind of like molten mounds because of water falling on them in the rain and so forth. Whereas the pyramids stick out. I mean, when you look at the pyramids from a distance, they look as if they were built yesterday. Of course, when you're near, they're very eroded and the covers have gone. But they stood. They've been there for at least 5,000 years and maybe much longer, as we were saying earlier in this program. And I was talking about my brother who has his theory. You know, if you're going to build a structure that you want to last for a long time, you're going to build a pyramid, and you're going to build a large pyramid, and you're going to build it of stone, the natural stone.
Yes.
So, you know, that's one of the intriguing things, is that they chose all the elements of something that they wanted to last for a long time. This pyramid is going to outlast us, by the way. It may even outlast humanity. You know, God forbid, but if we disappear, this pyramid is going to be there.
Well, we know it would outlast most of our present structures, Robert. They say that in a few thousand years, maybe less, a building left untouched would just corrode to nothing.
Yes, indeed. You see, so for an architect to consider what would last for a long time, even perhaps forever in the sense of historical forever, is stone. You know, if you build in stone, and if you build in large stone, and if you build a monument the size of a pyramid, in the shape of a pyramid, then it has the natural shape. You see, imagine yourself doing sand castles in the beach. You know, if you pile sand up, it will naturally form a cone. You know, that's the natural shape of things because of gravity. And therefore, the pyramid already has that natural shape. That means it's not going to collapse. It's going to be there forever. And clearly, those who built it had this intention. They wouldn't have gone through all this trouble if they didn't have the intention of it to last. And the big question is, why did they want it to last that long?
And also, why did they build them?
Well, yeah. I mean, to me, they left a message. And the message has something to do with these stars, has something to do with the Hall of Record. And like I said, however cool you want to be about it, that's what comes out of the investigation.
Oh,
and you've got to face it.
That's exciting. West of the Rockies, Darren in Modesto, California. Go ahead, Darren.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good.
Robert, got a couple of questions about the Sphinx. A few years ago, I was watching a show about the Sphinx, and it was a geologist. Might have been the one you were talking about earlier.
Robert Chalk.
Yeah, was dating the Sphinx by erosion on the side of the Sphinx before they started covering it up, doing the restoration on it.
And that's probably John West, too, right?
Yeah, John West and Robert Chalk did the investigation. That's correct.
Right, yeah, I think there was two of them. But they were dating, from the erosion patterns, they were dating the Sphinx, what, 15,000 years old from the erosion patterns? And the second thing about the Sphinx, isn't the head out of proportion with the body? I mean, could have the head been somebody else or something else?
Yeah, they talk about, Robert, and Darren's right, that the head may have been changed. Do you think
right.
so?
Yes. Okay, let me answer this, Darren. John and Robert Chalk, like I said earlier, are very, very good friends of mine. And we converse on these matters all the time when we meet. The theory and research of Robert Chalk and John West started in the early 90s. Robert Chalk, let me indicate this, he's a professor of geology at Boston University. And John West approached him in the early 90s saying, listen, there is erosion on this thing. So I keep talking to Egyptologists about it, and they keep ignoring it. Do you want to have a look? And they both went together to Egypt, and immediately Robert Chalk realized that he was looking at unusual erosion. He was looking at what is known as vertical erosion made by, obviously, water falling down. Now, the problem is that there's not that kind of rainfall today or at the time of the pharaohs to call these vertical fissures. So his conclusion was, with other things, of course, he investigated the texture of the rock and so forth, and his conclusion was that the erosion was very old and that it occurred at the pluvial time, and the date he threw on it, to be conservative, was about 7 to 8,000 BC. John West felt that it was much older, maybe 15,000 BC. So that's to answer your first question. The second question you asked is the head. Yes, indeed, the head is out of proportion. It looks different. When you look at the Sphinx, you clearly realize that you're looking at two textures here. The body is very eroded, very, very dilapidated, and yet the head is still not so dilapidated. And indeed, it has been tampered with. As we said earlier, somebody broke the nose off, the beard fell off, but it still looks much, much younger. And it's quite possible that in pharaonic times, if this monument was there from prehistoric times, that the pharaoh said, well, I'm going to carve whatever was there, maybe a lion's head or something else, into my own image. And that's why Egyptologists believe that it is in the image of the pharaoh Khafra who built the second pyramid.
Robert, in the Egyptian code, why was there so much emphasis placed on the astronomical alignments then of the belt and other things?
Yeah.
Why so much emphasis?
I want to come now to the Egypt Code, which is a book coming out in a couple of weeks, I think.
I've got mine right in my hand.
You do?
It's out already.
How does it look like? I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen your own book?
Honest, no.
Well, it looks pretty darn good.
I've seen the cover.
Well, it looks great. Email. Pictures are great. Everything's great.
Wonderful.
Except this one's not signed by you.
Well, bring it to Egypt when you come.
All right, you got a deal.
Okay. Okay, the Egypt Code is this. There is something about pharaonic kingship that even Egyptologists acknowledge. They would take an oath. They would take an oath when the king was crowned. The king would take an oath, and what he would say is that he was responsible for what they called mat, which we loosely translate as the cosmic order. The king on earth was responsible to maintain the cosmic order, to maintain harmony in relation to the cosmos. Now, what does this mean? And they speak of the cosmic order in terms of the sky, you know, and as if Egypt was regulated by the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I finally came up with looking at these texts and pondering on this issue for a long time, and knowing that there was the correlation, these ideas that monuments like the Giza Necropolis represented constellations, is that the king was to ensure that Egypt was locked into the machinery of the sky. They believed that the sky regulated. It was like a machine that regulated the events on the ground in a form of astrology, if you like, in a form of practical astrology. And they weren't wrong. Indeed, the events that happen in the sky, if you like, the changing position of the sun causes the seasons and so forth. You know, we get growth of the plants. We live and die. We are caught in a perpetual cycle that is governed by the fact that our earth moves in a certain way. And therefore, this cosmic order in the sky changes, as I was saying earlier in the program, because of this precessional change, the slow change in the position of constellations and the position of the earth relative to the celestial objects. And what happens, you'll have to read the Egypt Code to go into the mechanics of it, but what actually happens is that one gets the impression that there is a movement from north to south in a span of time. We call this the sotic cycle, because one of the peculiarities about the Egyptians is that they invented the calendar very early, before any culture knew about the calendar.
Exactly.
And this calendar that they had did not account for the about quarter of a day difference in the solar year. As you know, the year is not exactly 365 days. It is 365 days and a bit.
And a bit.
Which is almost, but not quite, a quarter of a day. Now, a quarter of a day doesn't make sense to anybody. You know, there's no such thing as a quarter of a day. You know, we have day from either sunset to sunrise or mm-hmm. from sunrise to sunrise, but we don't have a quarter of a day.
So every 4 years we make it up by adding one, right?
That's right. Now, the Egyptians did not. They didn't add. Although they knew of this change, Egyptologists are clear on this. So the question is, why they did not adjust? Because, indeed, they believed that this was the order that they should not tamper with. The pharaoh took an oath not to change the order, to maintain it. And therefore, what would happen?
Hold on for there, right there, Robert. We'll be back. We'll take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. But on our next Coast to Coast show, Paul von Gwor joins us. We're going to talk about his work into reincarnation on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, their obsession with celestial things, to me, sounds like maybe they truly believed that they came from above.
You know, people who are going to read the Egypt Code are going to end up with the same feeling, I hope, that I have about all this, is that they seem to have been following or the instructions. The pharaohs believed that they were under instructions from what they called the gods. And the main issue of this instruction, the core of this instruction, was to leave something, a legacy, that is decipherable. They left us messages, and messages in stone that are to be read by every generation. And what comes out of it is that it seems that the whole of Egypt, not just the pyramids. Now, I did a big thing earlier in the program about the correlation with the three stars of Giza, the three pyramids of Giza, and the three stars of Orion's belt. When you read the Egypt code, you find out that these core correlation integrates itself with many other monuments in the area. Clearly, there is a vast plan here. And then one takes this idea further across the 3,000 years of accepted chronology of ancient Egypt. All seems to tie up, and one gets the impression that the whole of Egypt is a cipher. It's like a giant code. And if I'm right, it has a message. It has a message for us. And the message, at this stage, at least that I know, allows us to date. We're able to date things. They've left us a machine that we can tell the time. And the times that come out, again, whether Egyptologists feel comfortable with this or not, is of a far distant past than the accepted dates given by the experts. And that's what comes out of all this. So the impression we get is that there is something we're supposed to find out. It's like a sort of treasure hunt. And maybe, who knows, maybe Casey was right. We'll find out who we are. You know, there's a great saying by Graham Hancock, which I love. He says, we're a species with amnesia. We forgot who we are.
So true.
And this feeling that we exist not knowing who we really are needs to be cleared. Maybe that's the game. Maybe that's the whole process of us finding out where we came from, who we are. We're like orphans, if you like, seeking our parents. And to me, this is the exciting part of this quest, is to search, you know, and have the courage to go beyond the boundaries of accepted scholarship. You know, if your thing is to look for aliens, then go ahead. I mean, I say it's not my thing, but I'm open to the idea. If your thing is to search for an ancient civilization, go ahead, because you may be right. And that's the game, not to be blocked, not to be stopped by others who say, no, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You know, if I had listened to others, I would have published my books, I can tell you. You know, there was a lot of resistance from Egyptologists that I was talking to, but I did. And I opened a whole window to look at ancient Egypt in a different way.
You sure did. You opened up our minds, Robert.
We're in the process of searching. We're all on a quest. Each one of us, by the way. You know, don't think you're just an observer or a reader here. We all are here to find out who we are. We're to find out. Because when we find out who we are, we will know where we're supposed to go. And because we're navigating blind here, George, as we all know it. You know, we're not quite sure what to do on this planet. We're not quite sure what to do. And the world has become so turmoiled. We need a clear, unified vision. And until we know who we are and therefore what we're supposed to do to reach our goal, we're going to be in this confusion. So that's what I believe. And the ancient Egyptians seem to know. That's why it's worth studying them. They seem to believe that they knew. They were so convinced they knew that they left us this amazing legacy.
Man, this aerial photograph that you've got in your book is absolutely stunning of these pyramids.
Is it? I mean, you're making me jealous.
Oh, my God. You can imagine seeing them from outer space.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you, I mean, try it on Google Earth. You know, the funny thing about this is, you know, as you descend down, and anybody can do this with Google Earth now, over the Giza Necropolis, as you approach it, the first thing you see is the pyramids.
Yep.
Nothing else. I mean, you don't even see the city of Cairo. You know, they're there. They're like a mark. And you know.
Let's take some final calls here. Sure. Okay, Mike in Cleveland. Thanks for holding, Mike. Go ahead.
Good evening, George and Robert.
Yes.
Good evening.
Robert, great observation, sir.
Thank you.
Robert, above the King's Chamber, where the granite beams are, is the relief space where the red cartouche is located.
Yes.
The cartouche is not an etched hieroglyph, but a stained mural. And since the cartouche suggests the king who made it, and therefore the time period when the Great Pyramid was built, so, Robert, couldn't the dye used for the cartouche be carbon dated to determine if the cartouche was graffiti added after its construction, sir?
Yes. As you obviously are well informed on this. Indeed, they're not carved inscriptions. They are painted inscriptions with a red ochre. And they're very, very rough, really. I mean, that's why we call them graffiti. I mean, they were obviously put there by a non-scribe. I mean, maybe, who knows. But the big question is, first of all, who found them? They were found in 1836 by a British colonel called Howard Vyse. Howard Vyse was a strange man. In fact, I've just published an article on Howard Vyse. And just to digress a little bit, Howard Vyse was the first one to enter the third pyramid, the small pyramid. And in there he found a sarcophagus, which was he took out and shipped to England on a ship called the Beatrix, which sank on the coast of Spain. And as you can imagine, I just said earlier in the program that I live in Spain. There's now an attempt to try and retrieve the sarcophagus. So it's the big talk on Howard Vyse again, and which led me to investigate who he was, really. He was a rather strange man, and he went to Giza with the obstinacy of discovering something, and he didn't. You know, he kept on trying, and he used gunpowder, and he blasted his way into the pyramid. And therefore, one has to wonder about these inscriptions. Now, there are two schools of thought, as you know. One that says they're fakes, you know, that he or somebody put them there to somehow convince everybody that the pyramid was built by Khufu, by right. Cheops. And others who say, no, they're genuine, you know, and therefore they were put there by a builder, by some worker. I have to say that I've looked at both stories, and I'm still not convinced either way. Although one of the arguments put forward by the by those who say they're genuine is that one of the inscriptions, or some, I'm not quite sure how many, are within the joint, you know, that it's very, very difficult to write them inside a joint. But it's not impossible. It's not impossible. And therefore, it's too good to be true, if you see what I mean, you know. This moment when we needed, or at least the Egyptologists needed evidence, hard evidence, that Cheops built the pyramid, because they needed to fit it to their view, to their consensus. And here comes Howard Vyse, you know, with these inscriptions. It sounds too good to be true to me. And besides, they're put in a very, very strange place. And like I said earlier, if indeed Khufu built the pyramid, and there is a big if here, no matter what one wants to think, then why would it not be made clearer? Why not have engraved inscriptions? You know, so you know, there's a big question there, and I must say that I'm very divided as to whether they are genuine or not. But even if they are genuine, there is still a bit of a doubt whether they do really mean Khufu. They don't actually say that Khufu built the pyramid. It says it basically gives a name that is related to the god Khnum, and the word Khufu may not be a name. There is a lot of doubt about this, I must say.
Okay, thank you for that. Downtown Los Angeles, we go. Hello, Victor. Go ahead.
Yes. How you doing, Robert?
Hi.
And George?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Let's unravel the riddle of the Sphinx. I have done some recent studies. The Sphinx is comprised of four actual entities. You have the head, there's a man, and you have the body, which you said is pretty well corroded, correct?
Yes.
And that would be the lion. And I would say also embedded on the back of that sphinx would be the spread or just maybe the unfoldment of wings of an eagle. And as we all know, the body would be the body of an oxen, I'm sorry. And the feet, as we know, is the feet of a lion.
Hmm.
So we have four living creatures there, as would be in Ezekiel 1, as we all know biblically.
Hmm.
Okay, now let's go ahead and take this to the constellation. Now, the lion, we obviously know it would be Leo. Okay, now,
yeah.
As we know, the body of an oxen would obviously, an oxen is, a bull is a castrated ox.
Hmm.
Okay, so that would be a constellation of Taurus. Or say our zodiac, the two there will be zodiacs. Now let's go to the man. The man would be the Hercules, okay, which would be considered as the victor, okay, the conqueror. And then we have Aquila. We're all familiar with Aquila, right?
Mm-hmm.
That would be the eagle.
Yeah.
Okay. Now there are actually four of these particular embodiments or constellations are in the four corners of the universe, as we. Would say Leo is the northeastern hemisphere, Taurus is in the northwestern hemisphere, Aquila would be in the southwestern hemisphere.
Correct. Yeah.
And Hercules would be in the southeastern hemisphere,
mm-hmm.
representing the four corners of the universe. Now, if you really now look back and look at four of these creatures here, the lion, the oxen, the man, which is the victor, and then the eagle. There we have the word love.
Ah.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Now,
Yeah.
Anything that man would represent, the Lord God.
Let's get your take on this theory, Robert.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you that rather than speak of your theory, but what you mentioned is very interesting because there is no doubt in my mind, and in the mind of many researchers, that the language that is being spoken is the language of the stars, the constellations. In other words, the language of the zodiac. You know, we're to read that. And you're making an attempt to read that, and that's very, very good. And you may be right about the combination of these various creatures. But I have two things to tell you here that might interest you a lot. There is, in one of the temples in Upper Egypt, in the temple of Komombo, precisely what you've just mentioned. And I've been baffled by this for quite a while. At the back of the temple, there is these four creatures that you have mentioned, which represent the four colliers, what we call the colliers, the four points of the compass, the four stations of the sun, the two solstices and the two equinoxes. And therefore, they define, if you like, the corners of our existing world. So it wouldn't be impossible to imagine that the same idea is used by the Sphinx, that it represents the whole, if you like. I don't know about the word love, because one has to be a bit careful with ciphering of this sort. And I'm very, very open to such ideas because I'm persuaded that the language that is being used by these builders, whoever they are, and the message that they have grafted on their legacy is astronomical. Astronomy, or astrology, if you like, is the language. It's that language that... And it's not surprising, because it is... You find it in prehistory. You find it in ancient monuments, much, much older than temples. I mean, we know that they exist in prehistoric caves. And it brings me to another issue, which is this book I'm working on, because you may be interested to know, George, you may be interested to know this,
sure.
That we have found evidence of ancient astronomy, very ancient astronomy, in the Egyptian Sahara. That's why I went there with Thomas Brophy.
Technical astronomy or...
I mean, well, we don't know if it's technical or religious, but it's there
huh.
in the form of things that look like mini Stonehenges with rock circles and stone circles and strange burials that do not contain bodies. And these have been known for quite a while. Can I go on this?
We've got a couple minutes left before we got to wrap it.
Yeah, I'm going to... Now, by the way, In the Egypt code that you're holding in your hand, there should be two appendices. And in these appendices, they're not in the English version, in the British version. They're in the American version that you have in your hand. There are two appendices, and they speak of precisely that, the new discoveries. They speak of these discoveries made in the Sahara very, very recently, since the early 70s, and particularly last year. Some stunning discoveries have been made. I can't go into them now. Read the Egypt code and read those appendices. And hopefully when I finish my next book, because the title of my book should say it all. It's Black Genesis. We are finding that there was a huge lost culture in the Sahara. Gigantic.
What do you mean?
Of it everywhere.
What do you mean gigantic? You mean in size?
Well, in population.
Population, okay. We've talked about giants before on this show.
No, I don't mean in giants.
Okay.
I mean that we're finding that there was a prehistoric, very ancient culture that escaped our attention. And they were there when the Sahara was not as arid as it is today, when it is fertile. And I went on an expedition in April in the deep Sahara, in the extreme southwest of Egypt, an absolutely bizarre region, I can tell you.
Well, this is riveting. Robert, we're out of time, but look, you're invited back here anytime, my friend. And we got to plan our trip to Egypt together, okay?
Indeed. I look forward to it.
All right. Robert,
thank you very much.
Robert Bival, The Egypt Code. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Gina Salvati, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.